So this, the title of this talk is Deepening Loving Kindness. I know many of you have heard me speak about loving kindness and the Brahma Viharas before, and some have not. So I'll some of the material may be a review for some, certainly, and then I'll try to say some new things. The one thing that I hope to get across first tonight is that the way we approach the technique for loving kindness can make a powerful difference for us, either in engaging in the practice first of all, and then also for deepening the practice. As I often say, I find these techniques genius, just pure genius, amazing, passed down to us generation after generation, century after century. Like a bit like an oasis, something we can take refuge in. They're, as is often said, simple but not easy, and they work in brilliant ways. So when we do our insight meditation, our mindfulness practices, one of the variety of things that's happening in those techniques of practice, where we're anchoring on the breath and so on, is that we're training and strengthening our attention. And a key point for this journey and why this particular way, spiritual practice, way of spiritual journeying that comes from the Buddhist tradition, engages in a lot of meditation is because in normal civilian karma, in our ordinary life experience, attention is not strong. It's very, very distracted, and this is actually due to the ordinary habitual conditioning of the mind and the mind-body process. It's just very, very distracting. Life is distracting. These sense doors are distracting. The mental formations are distracting. And yet at the heart of this path, there is the request, the assignment to see things clearly, to see truth, to see things as they are. But our ordinary perceptual structure is very distracted. So we actually need to engage in training that will help us learn how to focus our attention and then also teach us where to focus it. The breath practice, the attention strengthening practice in the Tibetan tradition, they use the Sanskrit word shamatha, and it's often translated as calm abiding. And the way it's explained is that we want to learn to move our attention somewhere, to place our attention on something, and then train in the strength of that so that our attention will calmly abide where we place it. Now, for some people, it's easier than others. Some people have a natural ability to concentrate, and some people have had, also in their work lives, have had certain kinds of training that helped them has helped them throughout their lives to concentrate. Now, mathematicians are very good at concentrating. When it takes 3 days to do one proof, you'll have a strong ability to concentrate. People who have trained in dance or body disciplines, Tai Chi, Karate, Aikido, will have yoga, will have a strong ability to place their attention inside their body sensations. So some people, through natural ability or through their work or other ways of practicing, have a stronger ability to calmly abide, to place their attention somewhere and calmly abide there. But all of us can learn, and it doesn't need to become super strong, the concentration, but enough to rest, for example, with the anchor, the breath sensations, and then to notice when the mind has wandered and to see what's actually in the mind so that we can see desire, craving, clinging, so that we can see aversion arising in the mind, the habit of aversion. So this is one important big aspect of our mindfulness practice. And then for the loving kindness practice techniques, we're also training to place our attention somewhere and let it abide there. And what we want to use is a feeling in the body, a feeling in the heart, the feeling of loving kindness itself. So the technique is set up so that we can learn how that feels, first of all. So we have this category of focus we call the loving kindness benefactor. And we need to pick a benefactor being that will be effective for this. One of my Tibetan teachers say a juicy benefactor. So we have a choice. We can choose from our own lives. I have one student who her grandmother, when she's my age, but her grandmother when she was growing up was such a powerful influence in her life, all to the good, that still now that's her loving kindness benefactor. For me, it's been for 30 years the Dalai Lama. That's the being that I imagine and visualize for my loving kindness benefactor. For people in other spiritual traditions, you sometimes take other being. You know, Christians might take Jesus or Mary. So there can be beings from the wider world. Last year, Bishop Desmond Tutu visited Tacoma, and you remember when he visited with the Dalai Lama here in Seattle, and the two of them together, so many of us in Tacoma fell in love with Bishop Tutu. So some people, he's their loving kindness benefactor, or the two of them together, the Dalai Lama and Bishop Tutu just laughing when they poke each other, and they're like little boys, best friend little boys on the stage. It's very sweet. So you can choose a being from the wider world or a dearly beloved pet. Some people, it's a pet they have now or maybe their childhood puppy. But it needs to be a being who just the thought of, invariably, you will feel this feeling, gentle friendliness. Bhante Gunarata calls it loving friendliness. Sometimes we call it loving kindness, metta, to feel the feeling itself. So some folks, that takes a while to find a benefactor. And for some, maybe there isn't even a person like that or even a being, but a few people have found that a geographical location, maybe some place in their childhood that they felt very safe. So that's a possibility as well. But we want to, at some point with our practice, sooner is better, but later is okay too, have a feeling that we can be aware of as the feeling of loving kindness, so that we can place our attention on that feeling and our attention can calmly abide there. So when we're doing the practice, we have the phrases, different teachers, different people use different phrases. And then we have the feeling. And as we're saying the phrases, if you can also move your attention to that feeling, if you can generate the feeling, and then have attention, place attention on it. Over time, that sense, the sensation, much like all become so familiar with the sensations of the breath, or sometimes with the problematic mind states, we track them very carefully. We know very clearly and carefully all the sensations of fear in the body or worry, which is good mindfulness practice. But to know more and more this, how the body feels, this feeling of friendliness, of loving kindness. And that will actually help deepen this practice, to have not just the phrases, but also the feeling when it's available. Of course, we know with this kind, our kind of practice, we're taking things as they are. The loving kindness, we are intentionally manipulating things a bit. I think it was someone in this group said that one time, that they felt that it was somehow contrived. And I said, that's because it is. This is what we call a relative world technique, a relative reality practice. That yes, in absolute reality, there is non-self and empty awareness and so forth. But in the relative reality, there are individuals. And so there are practices for that, and this is one of them. So it is somewhat contrived, but as we get the flavor of the body sensation or the feeling in the heart, or even the feeling in the mind, it becomes a bit more tangible, a bit more sensory, and that can help us deepen the energy. And then as we say the phrases, may I be happy, may you be happy, there's also the sense of offering them. As Sharon Salzberg says this quite often, using the word offering, that we're actually offering the phrases and the feeling to the benefactor, to ourselves, to our dear friend, to other dear ones. There is an internal sense of making an offering, making a gesture. It's a bit of a gift, this feeling of friendliness. And then we are also very clearly formulating an intention. And we know from our study of insight meditation that the moment of intention, mindfulness of intention, is very, very powerful aspect of the practice can be, because that moment is where what we would call the karma can change. That we experience all kinds of things arising and passing as a result of previous conditioning, previous habitual patterns, and they will continue to play out and play out unless we engage in practices like mindfulness practice, where we can actually begin to insert awareness in the chain of experience at the moment where intention resides. at that, what Joseph Goldstein calls the about-to moment. So, and I'm sure many of you have practiced noticing this in speech, in ordinary speech situations. This is a great place to practice mindfulness and awareness, and particularly to notice the intention behind the speech before we say it, if possible. That's what we're working toward, to get to the point where we can pause and breathe and then make a choice about following through on a particular intention so that our intention can shift maybe from reactivity to goodwill, something like that. So we are practicing seeing and learning about noticing the moment of intention. And then with loving kindness practice, we can insert that very, very clearly right at the beginning of each sentence when we say, may all beings be happy, may I be happy, may you be happy. The word may, some people object to it, you know, as we understand all of this is coming to us in translation. And we're in this period of history where all of these teachings from a variety of countries and languages are being translated into another variety of languages. You know, it's all been in the last 100 years, this massive, great translation project. This is due to airplanes, basically. You know, in the past centuries, the Buddha's teaching moved more slowly and through geography and was translated very slowly. But wow, this last 50 years particularly, it's been amazing. So people, translators, are choosing English words, Spanish words, Italian words, you know, that would hope to work, to communicate. So the word choice is may all beings be happy. Some people, the may, is, English speakers say, it makes them feel a little bit like that phrase when we were kids, mother may I, yes you may, was that game that we played. So that somehow there's a quality of maybe begging or asking permission. So I always mention to the folks, the beginners, if you can take the English word may and think of it as almost abracadabra, you know? That, or I say Tinkerbell or Glinda the Good Witch. You know, it's like, bing, may you be happy. That's the feeling you want, as opposed to a begging kind of use of the word may. So that you can plant the intention in that moment. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free from suffering. And so what will happen then is we're lining ourselves up, our awareness and our attention with this feeling. We're placing our attention on the feeling and on the phrases. And then also we're being very clear that every time in our minds, if we're saying it silently in meditation, or maybe in the car we can say it out loud, but however we're doing, some people sing, they've made a song of the verses of loving kindness. However we do that, at each beginning line, may, we want to clearly, very clearly realize that we are planting a seed of intention. We are formulating intention. And then we'll be able to concentrate more. We'll also be able to feel the power of it a bit more and have confidence in the results. Because the teachings tell us that the wish that other beings be happy, that we be happy, the wish of loving kindness, the intention, the resolve. Some people will talk about these as metta resolves. The resolution, the resolve that all beings be happy is tremendously powerful. Goodness itself is powerful in terms of what it creates. The Buddhist tradition is all about cause and effect, seeing cause and effect. And one of the greatest, that goodness itself is a great cause that will result in more goodness. And then within all the goodness, the causal goodness, the causing goodness, within all of those things, to be wishing and resolving that other beings be happy and be free from suffering is tremendously powerful. When the Buddha taught about it, he mentioned the lights in the stars in the sky would be like the power of goodness. And then he said the light of the full moon that level of light is the power of loving kindness. In terms of your own karmic stream, the results that you will someday benefit from, the planting of seeds, very, very powerful. If we can line it up with that intentional energy. So, to deepen the practice, placing our attention at the feeling if we can, and resting it there, and then also our attention on the moment of intention every time we recite the sentence. Tremendous power there. Then the next thing that can happen is we can begin to understand a shift that occurs in the technique, whereby we begin with benefactor and ourselves and a dear friend and maybe more dear ones and so forth, beings that we have a personal relationship with. And then in the various styles of the meditation, one way is to move to a neutral being. And while some people, I always, you hear the chorus? Always when I come, they kind of punctuate things. They're practicing beautiful music. So this moment, the neutral person or picking a stranger, while it actually sometimes seems to us when we're doing the practice that it sometimes pales out a little bit or loses some energy, actually this is a very profound moment, the profound category, because we're crossing now into the possibility that loving kindness can reach out beyond the personal, beyond our personal lives and who we love and care about, and to the impersonal. And again, this is it's a shift that's very subtle but very, very profound, because that also brings the spiritual, the level of it being a spiritual practice, quite deeper. That beings would actually now will also reach out to those we've never met, to those we have no personal connection with. So even though the feeling may feel when we begin with that a little flat, that's okay. But we need to do it anyway and understand that something very profound is actually happening at that moment when we're moving from personal to neutral to stranger to those that we have not yet met. And so then we begin to make a connection with those. Sometimes it's very nice to reflect on how many ways our lives benefit from people we have never met. And particularly in the society we live in now, it's quite profound. You know, many people used to know who made their clothes. But now there may only be a few people in the room here who would know who actually made the clothing that they're wearing. Or those who built our cars, computers, all the technology, those who grow our food, transport it. You know, the room is probably full of people who work in helping and healing professions. People who teach our children, people who protect us. There are the people who work on all the committees of government. Ah, offer them metta. Yikes. So when we look around, I mean, the people who fill the potholes, you know, which protect your car and your tires and all of that, I've never met those people. So much of our lives now are supported by the work of people we have never met. And so that reflection will help get the juice in there as we reach the loving kindness out beyond the people we know. So we want to insert that also somewhere in our practice, that memory, that reflection, that knowing, that when we see the beings on the in the other cars in the freeway, there are real people in there. They have lives. They have families. They have children. They work. They work hard. And we want our hearts to be able to connect in that way. And that will, again, deepen our experience of loving kindness. And then this practice of loving kindness comes with the teachings of Theravada style called the four Brahma Viharas, the abodes of the gods. The abodes of the Brahmas. In the Tibetan tradition, they call them the four immeasurables. They're kind of emphasizing the goal. We might move from ordinary love, compassion, joy, and equanimity to extraordinary, immeasurable love, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. So these are the four energies that the teaching offers us. Explaining these qualities, these flavors of the heart itself, and how the heart can develop these and then strengthen them to such a dramatic and powerful extent that they might someday, some life, become immeasurable. And they say the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, that's what they experience, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity that is immeasurable. So recently for the beginning class I was teaching, I was reviewing Bhante Gunaratana's book. It's been out for so long, Mindfulness in Plain English. And when he speaks, I think it's particularly in the revised edition in the afterword somewhere, he speaks of these four Brahma Viharas and gives the most wonderful example to us of what these actually are. So he says, you can think of this if you think of parenting. So you take loving kindness, and so you have a woman who becomes pregnant, and the mother of the child, the coming child, and the father, and then the child is born, and the mother and the father, or the primary caregivers, whoever, immediately fall in love with this little being. And some people say, you know, immediately realizing they would throw themselves in front of a bus for this small being. Just right away, this sense of love that is beyond me, beyond the personal. I never had children this life, but I, thinking about that, I was remembering, I was raised Catholic, and I went to Catholic school, I went to Mass every day. I just loved the spiritual practice. I never met a spiritual practice I didn't like. So whatever tradition I was born in would have been fine. But so I remember, and this was the 50s, and I grew up in the Chicago suburbs, not all that far from the Nike base. And so in the 50s, we were doing these, as some of you may remember and others of you have heard about, these exercises of somehow hiding under your desk when the nuclear war came, as though that was going to help, right? But and living near the Nike base, when I got old, I'm about 12, I realized nothing was going to help, and somehow that seemed like a relief. But in that window of time, I remember hearing all these things about, you know, disaster and the wars and so forth. And I remember, and I think it was the religious part of me, I would pray that if whatever was happening, if it could just wait till my parents were done with this life. Because they'd lived through, my parents were a lot older, they were double generation older. So they had lived through the crash and that whole economic situation. And as I say, my father used to say he grew up in the slums, but my mother's family was really poor. So they had lived through all of that. And so even as a young girl, that's where, as I say, I haven't had any children, but I realized that that was my first experience of the loving kindness reaching outward, that I somehow put it together and prayed that they could please just not have to go through a second round of that in their lifetime. So we have this experience of loving kindness where with the little baby or some being in our lives, or maybe it was a sibling, that we started to care for more than ourselves. And then with the parenting, then as the child gets older and starts to trip and fall and hurt themselves and so forth, and have the compassion, the parents and the caregivers' compassion, again, just arises so easily. You know, you see your little one hurt, and you even wince, that kind of feeling. Or I always remember my friend with her first grandbaby. She's talking about compassion, and she said, when this baby had his first cold, and you know how babies, they don't know what's happening, but it's very unpleasant for them, and they're crying. She wanted to just lay down next to him and kind of inhale the cold, right? And so many people, you feel that way with these tiny beings. So that is this feeling of compassion, that you care again someone else's suffering more than your own. So compassion comes quite easily. And then Bhante-ji said, then the child goes to school and then later to work, and all their successes we celebrate, whatever it is, you know. If it's just a grade that's a little bit better than their last grade, or they're able to complete something, or when they go to the school dances or the sports, whatever it is, there is this ability, we see it in our hearts, to rejoice at another's success, to rejoice at another's happiness. So that's mudita. So we had metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, and now mudita, the ability to rejoice at others' good fortune. And we know how that feels in the body from these life experiences, perhaps. And then finally, equanimity is required. When the child finally goes out into the world to make a family or work or whatever it is, the parents or caregivers have to let go of their attachment to what this person does, but they still have tremendous love, compassion, and want them to do well. But not a good idea to try to manipulate and control after a certain age. It's just not a good idea. So equanimity, balance, and allowing a person, this young person, to have their own life, to unfold their own journey, their own karma. So that example is so good. It's very, very good, because it gives us this flavor, the feeling and the flavor of metta, karuna, compassion, mudita, and then equanimity. And when I do the guiding of the meditation, and I do the loving kindness, and then I do a longer one where I will ask people to actually feel the feeling of compassion, and then offer the phrases and the feeling. And again, we want to generate it in our experience somehow. So we think of a person or a group that we care about and also we know is in some difficulty or distress. So we combine those two things, our caring and our knowledge of their pain or their distress, so that, again, we can actually generate a feeling that then we can place our attention on the very feeling. And then we offer them the phrases of compassion. You know, the traditional ones, of course, may you be free of suffering and all of its causes. But then for me, in order to get the feeling more tangible, I would say, may you be comforted, supported, protected, cared for, healed. So as I go through those words in my mind, then the compassionate feeling gets stronger. It has more basis, more reality. We want people to be protected, want them to be comforted, cared for, and finally surrounded with kindness. And I like that phrase because even, you know, when your dog is lost and you don't know whether you're going to find it or not, but however what happens to that dog, may it be surrounded with kindness. You know, so that and even when people are at their final time in their life and dying, it still applies. Wherever the journey takes you, may you be surrounded with kindness. So for me, that makes a very strong, compassionate feeling. May you be surrounded with kindness. And I can rest my attention in that feeling. And then we really need to offer that to ourselves. So that can be very, very powerful to bring to mind whatever we're going through now, or if we're in a wonderfully fortunate moment in life, that's great. So then we can think of maybe recent past or even distant past, even our childhood pain, our childhood suffering. And then we can say, may I be free of suffering and all of its causes. May I be comforted, protected, supported, cared for, healed. May I be surrounded with every kindness. It's really a powerful thing to offer that to ourselves and to feel that feeling. And then again, of course, we can move it outward. So again, we place our attention on the feeling itself. We see if we can have an experience, the flavor of compassion. Traditionally, they say it's the quivering of the heart in response to suffering. And then we can offer it to ourselves and to all those who suffer in any way, in any being. Any way that they suffer, may they be free of that suffering. May they be surrounded with kindness. And then we shift to this amazing energy, the practice of rejoicing at the good fortune of others. And they say in the teaching that this one is really hard to get to because, you know, all of these have a near enemy and a far enemy. And appreciative joy, its far enemy is, of course, resentment, jealousy, and envy. And the near enemy is actually insincerity. Yeah. Well said, huh? You know that one where you're telling, someone is sharing something wonderful and the response is, oh, how nice for you. And you just know from the way that was said, you know, just that insincerity. Oh, I'm so happy for you. But, you know, not. you can somehow feel that. Or of course it happens, you know, that we feel when we hear others' good news, particularly if we're feeling very insecure in our lives, the mind can often say, more evidence that I'm worthless, you know. So that's hard. So there's resentment, jealousy, envy. But an insincerity, but you know, if you can make your way through those, there's this lovely, lovely energy of rejoicing at others' good fortune. And again, we can taste that a bit with our dearest friends or our children, grandchildren, when they have any success whatsoever, and we feel that rejoicing at their happiness, their success, their delight. And then when I use the guide that one, I ask people to think of someone that they really love, that they love so much, that resentment, envy, and jealousy isn't going to arise, and who is also experiencing some good fortune. And that those two together, then you get the flavor of it. But if you don't have anybody like that in your life, what is suggested is think of happy babies, puppies, kittens, YouTube is great for this, right? So, because, you know, when you go in the grocery store and you come upon some just wonderful, happy baby, it's, you don't feel jealous at all. It just brightens your day right away. So that's to focus. And I, you know, my example is, this is the Snoopy dance energy, right? This is just Snoopy dancing for joy. So we want to actually activate that in the meditation session. And again, let the feeling come so we can place our attention on it. Feel what that feels like, rejoicing at someone else's good fortune. And then offer celebration. So we say, you know, may your happiness continue. May your successes continue. And the one that I came 2 years ago is, may joy never leave you. May joy never leave you. May joy never leave you. So it's a wonderful aspect of the practice. You just get this grin, you know, you can feel the endorphins. And then what very interesting part of this is, when we move this particular energy, it's called mudita, when it moves within us, it actually manifests as happy gratitude. So that's the flavor of the energy within. So then we intentionally think of something that we can feel happily grateful for or about. So this isn't the grumpy, you're supposed to feel grateful, you know, because people are starving somewhere. That kind of thing. You know, we've been scolded with the gratitude, and that doesn't work so much. Instead, it's just to think of something. So we, again, we intentionally think of something that we feel happily grateful for or about, and then we watch the feeling. We feel the feeling. And we're good at that because we're insight meditators, right? So we see, oh, what feeling comes up? Yeah, it is contrived, but still. And really, it's gratefulness, and it feels like joy. It feels like a cousin of joy, like it's in the same neighborhood. And then we offer, we just thanks. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And then I love, in the way that I have people doing this practice, we move that energy outward again, and then we let ourselves imagine, intentionally imagine, all the ways people might be celebrating something. There might be someone in the room have a birthday, an anniversary, and there are weddings, and there are births of babies, and there are people finding jobs, having successes at work, people having successes at school, people passing tests for certain kinds of licensing after trying a number of times, people passing their law tests. You know, there's all kinds of beings out there celebrating something today. Good, some kinds of good news after, you know, very difficult times, people finding a job or a place to live. And so we want to actually intentionally, again, use our imaginations. Think of that. Imagine that. And then allow ourselves to rejoice at their good fortune. So again, we generate the feeling, we place our attention on it, and then we offer the feeling and also the phrases. You know, may your happiness continue. May your successes continue. May joy never leave you. May joy never leave you. May joy never leave you. Always remembering that every time we say a sentence like this, it is tremendously powerful. It's straight from the Buddha. He spoke several times about the power of this intentional mental emotional act, this wish for rejoicing, goodwill, compassion toward others. So we construct that in a contrived way, yes, but then in that context, we take action that is extremely powerful. I should say, just for fun, I think maybe, well, some may know, some may not, go backtrack a little bit, because I mentioned the near and far enemy of these four energies, and people often want to know what they are. So the list is, we have loving kindness, metta. And the near enemy is, this is a translation again, it means something that seems close to it but isn't really it. so they call it the near enemy, selfish affection. So that's the near enemy. There's selfishness in there. It's not really metta. It's still not a bad thing to love people, even if there is selfishness. It's okay, but it's not the kind of loving kindness with a capital L. And then, of course, the far enemy, the thing that obviously is the opposite, is any kind of painful ill will or just downright hatred. And then compassion, the one that's close but not it, is pity, right? So when we're wanting to convey compassion to someone else, you know, we have to be careful with our word choice, because it can often come out as sounding like pity, and people feel that, and it doesn't feel good. And then, of course, the far enemy, the obvious one, is cruelty. And then appreciative joy, insincerity, is the near enemy, and resentment, jealousy, and envy. And then equanimity is the near enemy, is indifference. And of course, we understand that as we read the teachings about equanimity, we realize why that's kind of the fourth one on the list, and the one that's even the hardest to develop, because we have to keep the caring in our heart, keep the compassion in our heart, keep the connection, but also understand that, and the formal phrase for that is, all beings are the owners of their own karma. Their happiness or unhappiness depends on their actions, not on my wishes for them. So you can see how that phrase, without being backed up by powerful loving kindness, compassion, and compassionate energy, can feel like indifference. So we have to be cautious about that with equanimity. And then what's interesting, of course, the opposite is prejudice, and also craving and clinging. So a lack of releasing people to their own journey. And also prejudice. I often say, in our holy beings, we don't want them playing favorites, right? You want the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to be directing loving kindness to all beings equally, not to just their friends or their favorite people. You know, that's the feeling we want from our holy folks. And so that's the way it is, to not play preferences, play favorites, that kind of thing. So that's the near and the far enemies of these four Brahmaviharas. Then to review a little bit, or to say this in a different way, when we're practicing loving kindness, we're actually developing a certain intention. We're planting seeds of intention that will ultimately manifest in a change within our behavior. And the change will be that we will begin to be able to meet all kinds of circumstances with the flavor of kindness. And isn't that something? When that, and those who've been practicing this for a while can give testimonials to that. I never had the idea in my mind of, oh, I would like to be able to meet every situation with kindness. Although if someone asked me that, I would have said, sure, that'd be great. But, you know, our experience of our lives, there's a lot of reactivity, and there's a lot of fear, and there can be frustration and irritation and all of those other things that happen in all kinds of situations with all kinds of people. But over the years of practicing loving kindness, more and more a sense of an ability to default to meeting whatever it is with kindness. Circumstances that others bring toward us, circumstances that come up in our own life situation, to just meet it with kindness. The peace that comes with that, that sense of having that ability, because it is a result of the loving kindness practice. And then this, a second one that is really a wonderful one is that we will develop through doing the loving kindness practice another change that we will experience inside of ourselves is that we will no longer sort of feel or have the habit of dwelling in aversion, which we so often do. It's just a conditioned habit pattern. We look at our own experience, we look at other people's experience, and we see that there is this massive dwelling in aversion, that we experience some kind of aversion, anger, disappointment, worry, frustration, and then we dwell there. And we tell stories that dwell there. And sometimes we'd like a few of our friends to come and dwell there with us too, right? You know? So we recruit. But this is a conditioned habit pattern that is transformed through the practice of loving kindness. Also, of course, the mindfulness. I mean, you can't really separate these two. Our path in general, mindfulness and loving kindness. We see this thing. And we begin to shift this experience, and we also shift our intention. Once again, we decide we're not going to dwell in aversion. Of course, aversion is going to come up. Everything arises due to conditions. When someone describes certain conditions and then they feel embarrassed that they were upset or angry or frustrated or disappointment, and I say, well, why? You know, it seems like those conditions would give rise to that state. You know, not to be embarrassed about it, but then our path is to see it, but having decided not to dwell there. We can make choices. Sometimes we sit with it, sometimes we breathe with it, sometimes we shift to loving kindness toward ourselves or toward others. So we actually have this intention. We're no longer going to dwell in aversion. And then another thing, this is sort of the subtext of loving kindness, this list. What we are developing is the ability to feel kindness toward that which is inherently unlikable. Whoa, huh? Isn't that something? Remember the first time I read that, it's like, this is a marvelous path. Again, we sometimes on the journey, we try, you know, everybody who's a meditator has powerful, good intention for the spiritual path. I mean, it's just powerful. But sometimes we misunderstand things. And so we sometimes think, well, I should be able to find everyone likable. Or every situation likable if I'm a good practitioner of loving kindness. But that's not exactly how it works. There are situations, people, and circumstances that are unlikable. And yet, with our practice, we're not going to magically, poof, turn the unlikable into the likable. But what we will do is be able to have kindness towards situations, circumstances, and people, even though they're experienced as, you know, relatively or dramatically unlikable, still the heart opens. And again, you think of the holy beings, and you realize that's who they are. Everything, everyone, every situation, their heart is open. And so they're meeting all those situations with loving kindness, even the most difficult. And then the fourth one on this list of the results of our practice is that we begin to be able to accept all experiences, our experiences and the experiences of other beings, with an open heart. Again, it doesn't mean that we can't make a stand against certain appalling behavior, but we're able to distinguish the behavior from the person. And there is also a sense of compassion and a sense of knowing that certain causes and conditions can lead beings to horrific behavior. And again, while we're not approving of the behavior, and we know the behavior is causing them suffering, causing others suffering, but we can be open-hearted rather than completely disapproving and judgmental. And of course, that open-heartedness has a healing power, so that people who have been in horrible situations, terrible conditioning resulting in terrible behavior, when they're met with people who can meet them open-heartedly, they are helped and they are guided to change and to be able to move in new directions. But that's someone whose heart is open enough that they will not judge and condemn, but rather welcome people to some support and some guidance. So these are the things, the kind of the subtext of the loving kindness, the journey of the technique. You know, I talked a lot about technique and how we do it and where we place our attention and what we generate. But then the things that we see changing in our own life experience. We develop the intention to meet all our circumstances with kindness, and we cultivate the intention not to dwell in aversion, and the ability not to have to dwell in aversion once it's arisen. And then we also learning how to give rise to and even establish an attitude of kindness also to everything, but particularly to that which is unlikable. And then finally, the ability to accept the whole range of experience of beings in an open-hearted way, with a feeling and a flavor of open-heartedness. I'm watching the time here. I do this often, but I think it's worth doing once again. Sometimes in tradition of loving kindness, and certainly for the monastics, they do this every day. But if you're teaching about loving kindness or speaking of loving kindness, to begin or to end with a reading of the Metta Sutra, or a chanting of it if the Theravada monastics do the chanting of the Metta Sutra, the loving kindness scripture, the first of the scriptures on loving kindness. So I'd like to close the talk with a reading of that. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and not demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later disapprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small. The seen and the unseen. Those living near and far away. Those born and to be born. May all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. Thank you.